So welcome everyone. This is Daniel Four. It's sometime in July 2018, and this talk is an open introductory talk with discussion on animism, earth ritual, ancestral healing, those kinds of things. So I'm going to speak for maybe 20-30 minutes most, and then invite you all to bring your questions. You're welcome to type those in the chat even while I'm speaking, or make note of them there. And when it's time to do questions, you could type them in, you could raise your hand, which is a function in Zoom, or you could send me an email if you have no other way to do it, but make the subject line clear and make the question succinct, because I'm also guiding the call. So with that, let me say a thing, because some of you have met me or been to other calls before, but it's nice to locate oneself before trying to say a thing. So I'm American, European ancestor, German, English, Irish ancestry, early colonizers, settlers to North America from Pennsylvania. And then I grew up in Ohio. I live in Western North Carolina now, my wife and daughter and our cat. And I'm middle-class, cisgendered dude. I wasn't raised with any kind of Lorain County, Ohio, North Ritual. I wasn't raised with any kind of framework for relating with the other than humans or the ancestors, any of it. My parents are nice people, but they're not super spiritually tapped in. And so I sought that out in my late teens, sort of chaotically eating psychedelics and reading about shamanism, and then had the good fortune to connect with teachers when I was 17. And that was great. I had a good first experience with mentors, and that set me on a path of learning. So I have a undergraduate in religious studies, a PhD in psychology, I'm a licensed therapist, but I've spent a lot of the last 20 some years, I'm 40 now, really quite focused on ritual and training, and work with different teachers and traditions, and lived in different places in the world. And I'm an initiate and a practitioner of West African Ifa tradition. That's the Yoruba you heard at the beginning. And it's not so foregrounded what I'm teaching, but it's an important influence. I don't want to talk my own background to death, but the main streams that inform my work are psychology, earth honoring traditions and religion, religious studies, ritual more generally, and pragmatic actual ritual work, and then the cultural healing work that is just, it's the work of our times, the healing around whether it's sexism, racism, colonialism, earth disconnection, dogmatic rigid thinking, etc. And so I don't know that I'm an activist per se, but I try to hold my approach to ritual and ancestral earth reconnection in those sensibilities and that ethic. So the talk is intended to be on ancestral healing, animism, or I think I said animus, psychology, and earth reconnection. Well, that's a lot to cover in 30 minutes, but briefly, I've worked for years from the basic progression, and it's not so linear, of like a three-step progression to get your life in order spiritually. It's a little cavalier to say it that way, but it goes like this. First, handle your ancestors. And when I say handle that, what I mean is, and this has been the main focus of my work to date. I have a book written on this. I've trained people in this kind of work and done a lot of teaching around it in the last 15 years. But that looks like coming to understand what is knowable, what's retrievable about your own blood lineage ancestors and others that are important, and recognizing that some among them may be not yet at peace, that the dead do not automatically become wise, loving, and kind, and that they continue to have influence on us in the present, and they can change. Even if they were a hot mess during life, they can heal up. And so get to know who are your ancestors and actually come into relationship with the older, wise, healed, potent, benevolent ones, to assist any among the dead in your lineages who are not yet well, to make sure your dead are actually ancestors and not ghosts that you're dragging around like a cloud of dysfunction in your energy body, or that you're housing in your actual physical body because you don't have a place to honor them. The body becomes the altar. And so you're getting chewed up by your unassisted ghosts and your lineages. Like, don't do that. But we don't have a framework for it. And so to even suggest that that is a concern is news to some people. It was certainly news to me when I started to get that framework some years ago. So I suggest people have a psychologically friendly, trauma-aware approach to metabolizing intergenerational pain as it exists in your lineages and your bodies. So that's, it's kind of like therapy plus in a way. And the outcome of that is, if you do that work in earnest, is that you can come out of ancestral deficit and into the present in your life, not just personally, but also culturally, and realize, for example, you know, speaking from my own experience, wow, I'm sort of like an apex predator. I was like a white dude in America. And it means that, I mean, it's kind of a shitty way to say it, but it means that I'm socially positioned to have a lot of privilege. And there's responsibility that comes with that to constructively participate in some way that's in reasonable accord with my destiny and personal gifts, to participate in some way in a larger cultural healing or mending. And so ancestral reconnection includes increasing your awareness of your cultural position and not just feeling like a loser about it, but actually knowing how to constructively engage in shifting dynamics of oppression that keep our humanity and human community divided. That's plenty of work. But in addition to that, there's the land, the other than humans, the whole rest of life that gets obscured and erased when we talk about trouble on Earth as being only human-centric. The same appropriate awareness that is used when bringing attention to marginalized groups of erasure, of like telling history in a way that excludes certain groups or excludes certain concerns. That same kind of erasure happens with the other than humans. And generally speaking, indigenous, animist, earth-honoring peoples around the world tend to view the other than humans as part of their family, their community, their extended family. And so the, you know, the beavers, the pine trees, the stars, the mountains, those are kin. And when we harm them, we're harming family members. And they have the same kind of standing relationally on a heart level, on a legal, ethical level as other humans. So because we have such a tough time generally seeing other living humans as full people, and we're working out all that trouble, it's easy to overlook the personhood and the standing and the importance of the other than human. So that's an area of cultural repair, of reclaiming what I would describe as an animist framework, or some might call indigenous sensibilities, or some people associate that with shamanism, which is fine. It's not a language that resonates with me so well, but I respect it, and people who talk about it that way. On a more specific level, it means coming into conscious, reverent relationship with the land where you're at, even if it's a big city, even if there's no waterfalls and grizzly bears and fancy rainbow butterflies, that you actually see that the holy earth completely sustains you and that we're completely dependent. And that's not just new age garbage think, it's factual. And that real spiritually mature adults throughout human history have recognized and embraced our dependence on the sentient, complicated, weird, loving, destructive deity that is this earth. And that's good to grapple with. And once we embrace something like that framework that says, not only are other humans, but the other than humans, the plants, the animals, the elements, etc., all of them are different kinds of people that we ideally, ethically learn how to show up well with. When we embrace that framework, then we tend to live a more meaningful life because we're less lonely, and we tend to be more cracked open to grief because we're living through a catastrophe on Earth with no signs of abating, And so there's a need to get good at grieving. So you can't really open your heart to the reality of the others without seeing the agony that's being inflicted upon them. So there's that. But we also, when we embrace this frame, basically, come into more alignment and solidarity with the intact and resilient indigenous peoples and cultures of the earth. Assuming you're not indigenous yourself, per se. Indigenous is a complicated term, but, you know, we're not going to unpackage that here. So there's a paradigm shift that is totally fine, even for white people. Not only is it fine, but I think it's imperative for people of historically colonizer ancestry. I'm generalizing a lot when I say all of Europe is like that, because of course there's a lot of white on white crime. You know, Ireland gets colonized by the British, etc. But it's beneficial for other than white people, for white people to come back into humble, heart cracked open communion with the earth and the many beings. Because when your heart's online, you tend to vote better and have better ethics, and to just recognize our interconnectedness. So in addition to the ancestral healing, there's the earth reconnection piece. Of course, they're not so sequential, but I tend to suggest something like that sequence, and it's how my own ministry, I guess, is the word I was going to use. It's a little Christian, but it's fine. That's how my ministry and my tree-hugging ministry in the world is playing out, is first the ancestor piece, then the animism piece. Because if we want to be seen as trustworthy by the stones and rivers, we'll want to be a bit less ghosty and to not have the self-perception that we're an isolated being. Because the way the rest of the natural world often interacts seems to be one community interacting with another community. And so humans are a little strange in that way. On the spectrum of collective to individual consciousness, at least some humans really tend to have internalized the self-perception that we're very individual, which it's a delusion, but it's a delusion that has a real impact. So what I mean to say is that the rest of the natural world, humans who see themselves as individual look especially dangerous. And so if you want to look less, if you want to bliss out with your connection with the woodpeckers and the lightning and the groundhogs and everybody, then you'll want to look less dangerous to them. And they'll be more into interacting with you. And one way you look less dangerous is you become actually less dangerous, because you see yourself as part of a larger web of connectivity and implicitly like accountability in that way. So good. It's not that different from somebody friends you on Facebook. If you have 85 friends in common, you'd be more likely to accept it. If you don't know anybody, like they're not, yeah. I don't accept those friend requests typically. So the third piece, and then maybe we'll be in dialogue if that works, is clarifying your personal destiny. And of course these don't happen so sequentially, but so, you know, to recap, heal up your ancestors, get well with the land and the earth. And then the third is get clear about your specific unique gifts and original instructions or personal medicine or will with a capital W, whatever, however you want to talk about it, your specific trajectory. Why'd you come to earth? What are you doing here? In Yoruba tradition, we talk about the earth sometimes as a marketplace and the Orun, the other world, as home. So it's a trip to the market here. So where's your shopping list? What'd you come to learn? And what did you bring to the market? If you just think you came to the market to smell the smells and chat with people, you die and you're going to go home and your ancestors are going to be like, how'd that go? And be like, what do you mean? And be like, really? We sent you with a shopping list. We sent you with stuff. Did you sell it? Do you remember anything? And be like, sorry. Damn. Okay. Try again. It's a lot of work for parents to raise someone and then just have them be an amnesiac person. So there's an imperative we have ethically to not waste our life. We do a lot of killing just to live. as heterotrophs who eat the bodies of others. And so one way to hold that is that we have a kind of ethical responsibility to try to remember what we're doing here and to be helpful and loving and maybe even wise, something like that. What's important about this destiny piece is that there's not one. People will ask me, well, what practice should I do? I'm like, I don't know. It depends on what you need. Like, what's the right view on this? I'm like, I don't know. Be relational. But there's not a one-size-fits-all thing with spirituality. Some people need, it's not only that there's not one way that being awake looks. I mean, there are certain core values, I suppose. You want to not be a shit to other people. You want to be considerate. You want to be loving and all that. But beyond that, there's radical variation in style at how being conscious, aware of service, awake, whatever you think of it, looks like. So not only is the expression of it varied, the means of arriving at that level of presence are varied. And different people need different practices. And anyone who tells you otherwise is pitching dogma that probably worked really well for them. And it's possible it actually works really well for you. So you might get away with training with them. But then the risk is you're going to think that what worked well for you is going to work well for everybody else. And then you're going to either get the feedback and become less annoying or just stay annoying and be less successful. So the important thing is the appreciation of sacred difference and uniqueness. And generally speaking, as a generalization, indigenous or earth-honoring animist cultures, relational cultures that respect the personhood of the what we think of as nature, they'll tend to have views of the sacred that reflect the respect for the other than human world. And if you have ever spent time outside of a building, you know that there's tremendous diversity in form in the natural world. And if you value that and see beauty in that and take that really to heart on a deep level, it tends to translate into a way of relating with other humans that respects diversity as well. And says there's not only, just like the orchid and the hazelnut and the walnut are, they're different if you've met them. Three people you encounter throughout the day can be different as well. And you're not going to be annoyed at the other two because they're not like the first person. Like, they're really different ways to be beautiful and to be in alignment. So that's important. And what matters beyond the abstract is what's your way of doing that? And how do you get clear on what your specific way of doing that is and do that like hell until you die without apology? So you're really being a badass version of yourself, whatever that is. Because that's what's going to be most useful to the world. You're going to be most fulfilled by it. It's going to be the most satisfying. It may or may not be the most profitable, but it will leave you upon death feeling like you didn't waste your life, and that's important. So, what if I said just that? That's been about 20 minutes. It's good to see everybody on the call, by the way. I think, I don't know, it's maybe 30, 40 people. If you would like to chime in, otherwise, I'll keep saying stuff. But if you want to chime in, either type your question in the chat or there's a raise your hand thing at the bottom of the screen, probably. So you could do that, or you could find a way to take it off mute and say hello. If anybody has something, go for it. Otherwise, I'll think of some other deep thoughts here. It's one thing that's important. I'm not only, but a lot of the people that I work with and teach over the years and ongoing are people that were not raised with a framework for any of this stuff. And what I want to say is it's learnable. The stuff that, now you might not do this, but a lot of people I meet have an idealized picture of intact indigenous cultures that are all harmonious and living with the earth, and you know, the children are born and people sing them their song and remind them of who they are and all this stuff. Some people do that. It's actually kind of beautiful, but the idealization aside, there's something that really is nourishing and relational and connective about intact earth honoring systems. I've seen that in the last 5 years. I've made 4 pilgrimages to Nigeria, to Yoruba land, West Africa, and for initiations, for training, mostly in Ifa tradition, and have felt very well held, and at times really impacted by having it modeled to me, to have grown up adult men being affectionate with one another and worshiping the earth and the holy mothers. That's nice. It'd be nice if more adult men in the West did that. And seeing the kids well cared for in multi-generational ritual space, and to see people appreciate that not everyone needs to be the same, and there's not one right way to be. I could say more, but so some of the things that we might idealize about indigenous cultures are accurate. But the point I wanted to make is that those things are learned. Now, you can't recreate a whole village. You can have you can find 15 other people who want to live like that, and that's getting close. It's not intergenerational yet, but it's not inherent though. Even like someone raised as like a waspy, earth disconnected, materialist, Republican, Tory, whatever, white person can learn how to reclaim a deeply devotional, transformative, heart-connected, non-awkward relationship with the earth and the ancestors. It's learnable. I know it. I've learned it, and I step others through it. And there's job security in it. There's a lot of people who want that. And it's good. It's helpful. It's imperative right now for getting things turned around on the earth. I see one. Great. There's some questions coming in. What are ways to balance the lands around where you live from England? So that's I could riff on that a lot of ways because I don't have more context, but so let me just say some stuff. People sometimes get polarized around the topic of humans doing ritual with the intent of healing the earth, if you will. Some people will say, oh yes, the earth is a dying, sad victim that we need to rescue. And other people will say it's total hubris and arrogance to presume to correct the earth or heal the earth. And there's relevance in both perspectives, but most of the rituals that I've guided that emphasize relating with the other than humans, maybe a quarter of them have the intent of some type of healing or repair. And of that class of ritual, almost always that's living humans choosing to participate in remediating, tempering, cleaning up adverse human impact from other humans. It's cleaning up after ourselves, not just on a physical level, which is critically important, like cleaning up garbage or uranium or, abandoned buildings, but assisting the troubled dead who are part of the landscape to become more settled and at peace, to temper and soften harmful human impact in the past. So that's one very legitimate way to participate in improving there are acts of diplomacy as well. You're improving the trust between the humans and the other than humans in your area when you show up that way. And so I would say in general, get really well with your own ancestors of blood and ask them to facilitate a dialogue between you and the ancestor, human ancestors of place in a humble way, and between you and the spirits of the land who are not human and never have been. And from that place of really just deep listening, once you've really listened carefully and closely, you might hold the question, is there anything I can do to be helpful here? And let the land guide that conversation. And don't rule out bringing in people with more experience doing that to help you to get that dialogue started. But once it's moving, once it's flowing, then the land will let you know what is needed in general. And remember that the need may exceed your ability to respond to it. So don't sign up for something that's going to crush your life unless that's really how you want to play the one card you have of your life. So be mindful about your limitations, but do engage, start small and listen closely and bring your ancestors into it. It's good. Thank you for the question. So a question from Rebecca. Do I want to go into the conflictual areas piece of it? I had said to Rebecca on Facebook that I have a draw to conflictual spaces. I like the challenge of it, ritually speaking. And a friend and teacher, Sarangarl Odagan, this Mongolian shaman person who passed in 2006, said something that really stuck with me, that necessity drives ritual. And she's right. If you want to have a ritual be really dynamic, really slow down and ask what's truly, truly needed in a situation. And if you can identify that and let the ritual be a response to what's really needed, then things will tend to move in a more useful, dynamic way with it. And so there's plenty of need in places of, you know, historic trouble. Let's say, I know, Rebecca, you're in Germany, so there's plenty of human-to-human violence that is part of the even recent history of the land. And so there are rituals that I've learned that could be useful to a degree in situations like that. But what I'm really interested in is, let's say there were 5, or let's say there were 25 ritualists who are like, we're in the greater Berlin area. We have enough bandwidth for maybe a half day every month or two to do some kind of coordinated something, because it's an interesting experiment. How would we use that, you know, half day a year that spaced out, that we would be willing to play well with other people, put aside our pride and actually coordinate for the well-being of the land and the people here? That's interesting to me. And that's the kind of work I've done before in the San Francisco Bay Area, of working closely with the mountains around the bay. So I think it's rivers there. I assume there's some river that flows through Berlin, or else there wouldn't be a city there. And so you'd want to consult with the spirits of the river and have people upriver as well, and downriver. I don't think there's many mountains there. So you'd find some hills or maybe some outcroppings, and you find some anchor points that are not the river and that kind of delineate the overall space. And then probably pattern out from working with the spirits of the water and the river, because whatever kind of heaviness is going to need to be worked with there, which is substantial, the water spirits are a good tempering influence. Yeah. And there's something that feels kind of fundamentally different between Nazi ghosts and water spirits. And so it's judgy even in a way to say Nazi ghosts, because part of the teaching is allowing that the dead can change. And so part of what I mean also when I say conflictual areas, I'm speaking about the land, but really with respect to ancestral healing work, I have a soft spot for the dead who behaved so horribly during life that the instinct of living humans is to permanently exile them. And I think it's a self-defeating way of relating with the ones who behave very badly, because it creates a schism in our own sense of self. And it's like, it's all one, except for people who I really hate. So it's really two. It's me and the things I can tolerate when I'm in a good mood. And then all that other shit that's like the second category of things that I hate and will always hate. I'm like, oh, okay, it's interesting metaphysics. It kind of broke down at some point there, but that's not everybody's work to do that. But for those who are inclined to, I think there's excellent work to be done to safely bring in the exiled dead and put them to work for the greater good. Because the ghosts of those who were participant in the atrocities of World War II, let's say, not that that needs to overshadow all other things that happened in Europe before that, but it's so foreground, it's right there. So those troubled dead, what they most need is a job, doing something useful, because that's how they start to dig themselves out of, you know, massive karmic debt. And that's good for, it's restorative justice just with the dead, in other words. Yeah. So good. Thanks, Rebecca. That's a little bit on that. It's a big dear to my heart topic. I'm seeing your follow up here. Getting well with our own ancestral lineages is foundational for being able to do cross-cultural work with other groups of humans successfully. Because whether or not we're conscious of it, we are bringing all of our ancestors to each conversation anyways. And so we can do that consciously or unconsciously. It's not really, should I relate with my ancestors? It's more like, do I opt to continue to have that influence be unconscious, or would I like to bring it conscious? You know, we don't get to opt out of it. It's a structural thing. And the ancestors of others see that. And so, good. I see a question from Nelson, and then I think Karen. How to begin to connect with my ancestors? I have an unhealthy family on Earth, struggle with reaching out to elders. What are the basics? Sure, it's a big question, but let me say a few things about it. And I suppose it's a moment to plug my book, which is a manual on how to do that. It's written as a how-to book, and it doesn't assume prior knowledge. So, and thank you, Nelson, for speaking up. What's important, one, is that the recent dead, which includes those remembered my names, but also the historic ones, the ones we, let's say you have some guess about where your people were living on Earth for the last 1,000 or maybe even 2,000 years. You probably aren't very confident about it beyond that. Maybe, but usually not. That's still less than 1% of our history as Homo sapiens sapiens. It recently got dialed back to 300,000 years with new archaeology in Morocco. So it's really less than 1%. And if we, conservatively speaking, we've been at full behavioral modernity, like language and jokes and tools and all that, for at least 50,000 years before anybody left Africa. And so who our ancestors are not just the recent ones. And if your family has been assholes on every lineage for 4 or 5 generations, that's still just this last little blip. Like someone, you could be standing at the beach and there's an oil spill that just devastates the beach. And you're looking out to sea, and let's say it got 30 miles out to sea, and you're like, it's oil everywhere. The whole ocean is made of oil. I can see it. Well, it's not actually. It's the part near the beach where you're standing. And so expand the experiential framework for how you think of ancestors to include also the ancient ones who dwell in the present. That is a leap out of a Western materialist epistemology or framework of knowledge and into a more indigenous or relational framework or animist framework. I know, like I get that. So there's a leap of faith there. But the alternative is to project your experience of recent family, and I believe you that it wasn't happy, onto thousands of years of grandmas and grandpas that you're descended from and who also live in and animate your body in this moment. And so what happens is if you see your ancestors as losers, you have cultural low self-esteem, which is an important part of identity. So you can have individual healthy self-esteem, but if you think that who you are inherently culturally is like defined by being a loser, it's actually going to make you less effective in the world. Your service will be less effective. There's a certain amount of stubborn confidence and self-worth that you need to get anything done. Indigenous people tend to have that in spades because they just know they're magical because they're descended from all these magical, interesting things. And there's not a lot of inner conflict about that, generally speaking. I mean, colonialist interruptions aside. Yeah. So More tangibly, Nelson, there's a directory of practitioners. If you go to my website, ancestralmedicine.org, there's a directory of practitioners, almost all of whom offer low income sessions and by Skype or phone. And so consider the possibility of reaching out to any one of them and just having a session or two. And there's a lot of, there's just a little bit of effort to reclaim a framework up front for all this. And, you know, it's like if you're going to learn Spanish, you want to like get the basic overview, grammar, romance languages, how does this work down before you start heading into vocabulary. So know that there's a little bit of framework. But the last thing I'll say, if you were to start a practice today, is start addressing directly your wise and loving older ancestors. Ancient grandmas and grandpas, I don't know you. I don't know if we've even met. I'm here. I'm your grandson, granddaughter, however. I love you. And I think I love you. I don't know. I love the idea of you. Like, can you help me to know this is a thing? I'm opening myself up to the possibility that I'm part of a bigger network of forces and energy. So I invite wise and loving and kind ancestral energies to inform my life. And just start talking to them like that. It doesn't even have to be that scripted, you know, and you'll get the energy stirring. So that's good. Thanks, Nelson. There's a question from Karen. How to connect with ancestors brought over in the Middle Passage in the transatlantic slave trade? Yeah. Thank you for asking that. It's good. Having only the question here to go by, so I, at the risk of losing the relational nuance, my suggestion generally would be to connect with older grandmas and grandpas that lived before that interruption, before the arrival of Portuguese and British, etc., slave traders to West Africa and other parts of Africa, before the 1400s. And connect directly with those older grandmas and grandpas so that, and that sets up the possibility of a safe encounter with those who lived through the ordeals that came after them. Connect with the older ones who are wise, loving, kind, and tended to the ancestors actively during their lives. And because they did that, they trained themselves to be available to you in the present. They're imprinting on their soul a certain understanding of time that's not linear and that allows them after death to be available to the living as part of a larger network or rhizome or like organism of ancestral wisdom and consciousness. And if we make a distinction in Yoruba language between Alale, which is individual ancestors, or Ianla, Mabanla, like the esteemed mothers and fathers, and Egungun or Eagun, the collective spirit of the dead. And so when individuals join that collective network or hive consciousness, they can more easily be available through different moments in time, if you will. So connect directly with those who are decisively awesome and well. I don't mean to assume that your ancestors in spirit who lived through the Middle Passage and the ordeals of slavery in the Americas are not also well. They may be already deeply well. It's not my place to assume that one way or another. You would have to check in safely. But I feel certain that if you go back to before those ordeals, that there are wise, loving, kind ancestors who you could connect with this afternoon. Like, they are so available. You just make the space for it, drop in with them. And if it turns out that some between them and you, on whatever lineage you're focused on, are not yet well, those older ones will also have the capacity to assist those ones who are not yet well to become more seated and welcomed into the ancestors finally. And that's an act of service that you can bring to them, because they don't want their lives to be defined only by suffering or hardship. I hope that lands all right. Some of the same principles are fit with any like massive historical trauma. Someone could ask, how do I connect with ancestors who lived through the time of your initial European contact with native cultures? or who lived through or died in the Holocaust, for example. And my first instinct when those questions come in a general sense is you don't do that right off, because there's a risk that you could tap into a field of energy that is the collective suffering of those historical traumas in a way that not only could flood your nervous system if you're not really adept at grieving, but could bring into your space unmetabolized, heavy, difficult energy that is more than you're equipped ritually to deal with. And so the approach is to connect with the ones who are quite well and healthy and vibrant before that time, and then let what happens follow, play out in a little bit more structured and safe way. I'm glad, Karen. Thank you for the reply. Be hopeful that they're right there and available to you. Just hold that filter that you're only open at this time to connect with those who are already wise and loving, and you should be all set. So thank you. Seeing some other questions, and then I see also Lisa, you have your hand up, so I'm going to circle back to you as well. From Leslie Graham, I'm terrified of the unseen. Great, that's a sign of faith and devotion. Seriously. Yet I totally agree with ancestral healing and need to overcome this fear to begin this work. Yeah, it's great. I'm always happy when people have a lot of fear of the spirits and stuff. It usually means that, not always, but often it means they have more recent like Native or African ancestry, because the healthy respect for the other world is more culturally maintained. It's worse when there's... It's not unique to white people, but when white people are like, it's all love and light, I'm like, oh my God, do you leave the house? Like, it's so not. Read the news. Come on. And because it's the physical and the seen and unseen world mirror each other. So any kind of horrific thing in this physicality has an unseen complement. I don't mean to be so judgy about it, but maybe I do, I guess. It's just that the view that things are inherently safe because they're in the unseen, it seems to arise from a certain kind of insulated, privileged life experience. Or it can be just like spiritual fragility. It's like the equivalent of white fragility, but with the spirits. And so but seriously, to your question, how do you, don't dismiss the fear, listen to it and understand what the fear is about. If the fear is that you're going to open up a portal to unmetabolized ghosty trouble that will become lodged in your body and cause you to die, then that's a legitimate fear. You need to not just open up, don't open that door. Go to the other door, which opens to the wise and loving and helpful ancestors. So it's dangerous to engage with the ancestors, but it's dangerous to avoid them as well. And so the way to approach it is with trained support at the start until you get the hang of it. But the general stance, to make it very simple, is, hey, all you loving, wise, awesome, protective, beneficial ancestor people, why don't you come be real close to me so I feel safe and held and protected, and make all the weird ghosty stuff that I'm terrified of legitimately, because it's actually dangerous, be farther away from me so I feel safer, not because it's a mental trick, but because I'm actually safer. Like, that's what we do at the start of the process. So working with ancestors calls for strong boundaries with the dead. Like, it's not different than humans, like living humans. Like, if I'm like, yeah, why don't you go meet some people, go out to a party? You're like, but some people are dangerous. Like, they totally are. Not everyone at the party will be dangerous. Let me help you to, like, get in your body so you can know the feeling of this doesn't feel safe, and you know how to back up when you encounter that. So a lot of it's analogous skills to learning how to navigate living humans who are dangerous too. So but be hopeful. I hope that didn't make you more afraid what I said. Yeah. reach out if you want and have a sense of humor about it. At a certain point when they're big scary ghosts, you can be like, yeah, I got a body. I'm going to go have a hamburger and watch Netflix and tune you out. They're like, no, don't do that. We're scaring you. Right. So good. So I see it something from September. I used to hate my heritage because I felt they were loser farmers. It's good. Simple people. I hated to be associated with them. Yeah, totally. And I love when that story flips. Sometimes in the trainings, I ask people to ask their loving and wise ancestors, what are some of the gifts and blessings that come to them along this bloodline? And sometimes the gift and blessing is we were ethical people. And they're like, man, I thought it was summoning lightning. I'm like, you must not have met unethical people, because if you have, you would know that being ethical is actually a total superpower. And the ability to, like, if you've known hunger, the ability to successfully grow food, that's a really precious gift. And so it's a developmental thing. We struggle and we get kind of stuck at these like teenage consciousness ways of being. It's like, I'm a loser. I'm the best. I'm a loser. I'm too big. I'm too small. And then that happens culturally too. My people are the best. White people are the best. Whoa, white people are horrible. Like both of them are white centering. And so, achieving averageness or like becoming regular sized is a really good indicator in your development. And so that's, the ancestors are helpful with that. They can help you to just become a regular sized person, which is the size of person that other regular sized people really want to relate with. So it bodes well for interactions with the other humans too. So thanks for the vulnerability, September Nat. Hope you don't feel like I'm teasing you. I get it. I thought my own family was the least spiritual thing in the universe until about 25. So it started to soften a little bit. practitioners in Victoria, BC. Yes, Shauna Jans. Send me a personal email if you need it, but S-H-A-U-N-A and then J-A-N-Z. Shauna Jans is a trained practitioner in the work and a really good person in Victoria. Let me go to Lisa because you've had your cyber hand up for a minute. I think you have to unmute from your side. So go ahead. And there, you're off mute. Go ahead.
All right. Fantastic. So I'm just wondering how you transitioned from the standard psychology world to what you're doing now. I come from a background where I was in the mental health industry for quite a while, and I always said that they were just misunderstood, and I was so upset about the amount of medication and catatonic situations these folks were put through. So I was just wondering how you made that transition.
I still am happy to claim that I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist and a doctor of psychology, partly because I like giving the field a hard time. And there are also, it's a big question. There's a lot I could say about it. I wrote a dissertation on the use of shamanic healing methods in a clinical mental health setting. I have the view that mental health professionals are behaving in a less clinically effective way and being culturally damaging and implicitly racist when they perpetuate colonialist frames of healing that only value other living humans and fail to draw on the psychological healing resource of connecting with the other than humans. So psychology unconsciously, implicitly only values other living humans, and it's bullshit. And not everyone does it. They're eco-psychology people. They're spiritual people who are just flying under the radar in order to do good work. So it's not everybody, but it's most people. Mm. And so psychology itself is embedded still in that reductionistic, like essentially colonialist paradigm, despite all the other things that are awesome about it. Psychology is really quite skillful in a lot of ways about human relationships with other living humans and with themselves. It's just a very incomplete map of relationships overall. So I find that what is awesome about mental health, applied therapy type stuff, psychology, all that's legit. It's just super incomplete. or most of it's legit. Some of it's judgy still. And but it's changing. You know, it's a work in progress. And a lot of what we get into with the animism material when I'm teaching that is how to take what's good about psychology and apply that to relations with the other than humans. So how do we take an ethic of consent, being mindful of boundaries, and apply that to how we approach food? Everybody on this call and everybody who ever listens to it kills to eat. We are killers. We are heterotrophs. You may kill plants. You may kill animals. You may pay other people to do your killing for you. But we participate in killing to eat. That is the structure of being an incarnate human on Earth. And do we turn toward that? Or do we deny that we participate in that and get kind of sideways and squirrely about it and judge other people? And so it's not the best example maybe, but almost everything that applies to how we can mess up human to human relationships through projection, through failing to metabolize our trauma from past relationships, almost all that applies to how we do relationships with the other than humans. And so that's an exciting area for me that ideally falls under the umbrella of psychology. I never saw anywhere the fine print that says psychology must delegitimize the personhood of the other than humans and only focus on the experience of living humans. That seems a little narrow to me. And if it is that, then it's bullshit and I abandon it. If it's not that, then we should hold the frame and be willing to defend it, that psychology is most effective clinically and is most culturally healing when it includes and legitimizes the other than human people that we're dependent upon to live, that we kill to eat to live, and that we long for intimacy with. Yeah. So, yeah, that's a little bit, but I'm a big fan of clinicians who are sticking it out and who are being conscious within the field. And there's a ton of spiritual people who need therapy so bad. Like they really just need a lot of it because they're avoiding their stuff, their healing work. We take on damage. I mean, for people who live with their family until they graduate high school, which isn't everybody, it would be great if we had just like a 6-month nature immersion damage assessment period after that, instead of just unleashing all that trauma on the world. So we incur damage in the culture that, generally speaking, we grow up in. And so if you just dive right into spiritual practice, it doesn't automatically address that. So anyways, it's a few things about that. So because I'm trained in mental health, I feel like I can give the field an especially hard time. But as soon as, if people haven't been in therapy and they're just like, boo, psychology's dumb, I'm like, well, careful. It's actually more nuanced than that. So, yeah. So good. Thanks, Lisa. I hope that responded some. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. Good. Okay. I'm going to go to other questions. I see Lee chiming in from New York. In your Seneca culture, lineage is matriarchal and you have knowledge of your birth mother's family and you're getting to know them. Those ancestors you're working with, is your father's ancestral history necessary? As you've been told who he is, but don't have confirmation. So how to go forward? Yeah, great. It's actually a really good question and a common question. So in general, you start where the strength is and the resources with the ancestral healing work, because you need a spiritual win in most cases. So just coming into connection with what's already available or already healthy, or what you're drawn to, in this case, let's say your mother's lineage. So that's right for you as a Seneca woman. And from that, place of resource once things are really well with them. You can ask them, how can we together honor my father and my connection to the larger human family through him, and trust what your grandmother show you about that. It's to give a related example. Well, for one, you don't need to have a lot of information about your family history to get to know your ancestors. You don't really need any of it. It's helpful if you have it. It's typically painful if you don't have it. But if you don't have it, that doesn't need to stop you from connecting in with your wise, loving ancestors, because they're expressed through your blood and bones and body. And it's totally viable and possible to come into relationship with them. Well, I'm going to speak to a little bit of a related situation. So short version, be hopeful about connecting well with your dad's people, but start with your mom's side. And maybe with your mother's father's people is a good bridge step. And we can chat it more directly. I know you're coming to Ottawa, which is great. So people often enough will have ancestors that they don't think are losers and ones that they think are losers and want to connect with the cool ancestors. And ironically, because a lot of white Americans will judge their other than European ancestors for somewhat less racist people involved in spiritual circles, they'll tend to say, oh, I have some Native or African ancestry, latch onto that and be like, see, I'm not a loser. I'm not only white, and I want to connect with the African ancestors. And well, that's fine. But if you are suggesting that one group of people on earth is inherently better than another group of people, that's a kind of ancestral inflation or ancestral favoritism that on a larger level of scale can get quite problematic if you've studied the history of things like genocide. So I'm not a fan of cementing the view that one group of people on the whole is inherently cooler than another or better. Now, one group of any given person's ancestors may be harder to embrace because it's hard to see the value in how poorly they've behaved as a group recently. But the ancestral work digs into older layers. And so that reclamation is really important. And what it leads toward is reconciling or harmonizing different lineages, sometimes where there's been historical trouble between the two in the space of your own heart. And that's good. That can be challenging, depending on how disparate those groups are. But it's possible. To suggest it isn't possible is to say we're condemned to be not at peace and at a state of inner conflict because of the way in which we're down lineage from ancestral pain. And it's just not been what I've observed, that it is possible. Gradually, it might take a minute, but it is possible to work toward internal healing and all that. So, good. Scanning to some of the folks who haven't chimed in yet. And keep the questions coming. I see there's a bunch I haven't looked at yet. From Ron, as a mental health nurse, I agree that there are huge problems, but a growing number of workers at the nursing level that do think, and the counselor movement is forcing a lot of people to change too. Yeah, absolutely. Like, I don't mean to be too hard on mental health people. And when people ask me, I'm like, get your license, stick it out, change the field, stay positive. But I was just in a mood. So I was being grouchy. Thanks, Ron, for your service. Yeah. I'm going to circle back September just to make sure others have a chance to chime in. From Amara, I'm working with autoimmune chronic illness, and coming to see this work is key to that healing. Can I speak to that? Yeah, well, I don't want to be presumptuous or like to say, oh, well, if you do this, then this or that healing will happen. It's not my place to say that. But I will say that I don't really have the view at this point that there are very many personal problems. I think they're pretty much all systemic and intergenerational and cultural. And we register them as personal because the location of them is happening in the thing that you identify as you. But so it feels quite personal, You know, it's local. They're local problems, I guess, or local manifestations of systemic problems. And in that sense, it is a good move to address the way in which your ancestors may be impacting your health and to seek to remedy their troubles and to notice how that might beneficially reverberate in your own life. The degree of ancestral influence on any given trouble in the present is an unknown quantity until you actually inquire about it in a systemic way. It could be absolutely core to things shifting, or it could be one factor that builds more resilience. The way I tend to see a lot of approaches to healing is like we're at the convergence of these different rivers. And the idea of an individual is like putting a little circle around, you know, whatever, 30 feet around in a circle or meters and say, oh, this is me. This part of the river is me. Okay. The ancestral work metaphorically goes upstream, resolves areas of trouble there, and really, you know, as a byproduct of helping the ancestors, the water quality is better downstream at that place that you've identified as you. So, address it. See what is possible with it. There's a person, a practitioner in California, Irene Amar, comes to mind among the practitioners who especially works with chronic pain and illness. And I know you didn't say chronic pain, but autoimmune stuff. So, but yeah, that's a proficiency among the practitioners. So be hopeful about that, Amar. Thank you for speaking up. There will be a recording of the video on my site. I'm just looking at some of the comments. Okay, great. Others, feel free to keep questions coming. I'm going to circle back to some of the other questions. Is it possible that someone's saying that a couple things. For the practitioners, I'm going to type it in here, but basically you just go to my website, which is ancestralmedicine.org, and they keep trying to sell me .com. I'm like, I don't care. And go to ancestralmedicine.org and just look up practitioners. It's under practitioner directory. I'll type it in here as well. All those people are under my supervision. They're great. I care about them. They're good at the work. Most of them offer low-income sessions. And let me know if you have any trouble. I don't want to just plug all the events and stuff. There's a lot of events. And also, if I didn't mention it, if anybody is in Europe and wants this work to happen there, totally self-promoting the openness of coming to Europe next July through September with my wife and daughter. We're going to be in Australia next April. But next year is the get out of United States year. It's a little funky here right now. Sorry, rest of the world. Somebody's asking about schizophrenia and can it be inherited and related to disowning of psychic gifts? Yeah, sure. It can. Some people are going to be so fractured by just life circumstance or the way that they came into the world. We say in Yoruba culture, they have oriburuku. It's like a broken head, something like that, or evil, but evil is not the right word. Like there's innate trouble and it's harder to temper it. And so there's not always, like sometimes shaman people will say, oh, if mental illness was just related with as a spiritual emergence, then it would all work out. That's so fucking rude. It's not always going to work out. Some people are not going to get better. Look at the evidence on this. Like being nice does not automatically heal everything up. Not all suffering is the sign of a big spiritual awakening. That is a naive view that is shared by people who haven't been in the trenches with it. Having said that, certainly some kinds of suffering are really harmfully pathologized by modern Western cultures and would respond favorably to a much more kind and spiritual frame, and could respond favorably, at least some, to kinds of spiritual doctoring or intervention, things like that. Some people in any given family, they're like the, that's called an Inkisi in Congo. It's like a figure where you've seen the figures with the nails driven into it. And they're like the sink of the lint brush, or the thing that all the funky, heavy energy sinks into. Totally sucks if that's you, and may or may not crush your life. If it is happening and you're coherent enough to still reach out for help, then getting out from under that trouble is a good move. And one of the ways that you can start to try to get out from under it is to reinforce spiritual boundaries, work with the practitioner, and help those who are eating you, in a sense, or who are seeing you as the food, I guess, the troubled energies that are seeing you as their house, get them what they need in a way that does not compromise your well-being. And some very empathic, you could say, you know, inherently open, potentially spiritually gifted people come into the world like that. They're born into a family where the funky, ghosty energies are like, oh, this person's really tasty. They're quite open and interesting. And so then there's consequence, and nobody looks out for it, and those people get taken down. Now, I would say that, especially if you're going to be a spiritually minded parent, it's a responsible move to make sure that the ancestors of the family system are well in spirit and not eating your children. And it sounds a little grim, but I don't know, it's how it looks to me. Everything about my marriage and family training, marriage and family therapy training and ritual training tells me that most of the problems that people bring to therapy are, in one way or another, ghost problems. They're unmetabolized intergenerational pain. And when we see them as just personal problems, we create a distorted picture of the nature of them. And so you're not actually getting the full extent of it. The good news is that there's a ton of ancestral love and wisdom and potency and magic and weird blessing that, when called upon, can shift all that, or a lot of it at least. So it's possible to shift it up. We just need the framework for it. If somebody comes in and they have like a leech stuck to their face, and you're like, well, tell me about it. How are you feeling? You have something, you have pain on your face. I don't know why. If the leech is invisible, you don't believe in them, you're not going to catch it. But if you see it, and someone's like, oh, you got, this is stuck on your face, let me remove it. And then it's removed. And you're like, oh, I feel so much better. Like, yeah, you had one of those things stuck to your face. And so sometimes it's that stark that the dead have not transitioned. They're still hanging out with the living. They're a source of interference in the energy body and the space and the psyche of the living. And when addressed, then things clear up. Occasionally it's that stark. Good. There's a question: to what extent does healing ourselves and our energy field heal our ancestors? Can you explain a little more about how we hear responses from the ancestors and how we know they're benevolent? Good. It's funny. I don't know that it inherently does heal our ancestors to heal ourselves. I think it's good. Yes. May we be healed. But I've met a lot of people over the years who are, they're doing great. Doing really well. And they drop in and they see, and they ask, how are my ancestors? And they're not actually that great. In the same way that I imagine there's one or two people on the call who actually is a really well-adjusted, loving person with a dysfunctional living family. And you may have noticed that the more well you become, it does not automatically make your living family more well and wise and kind. I think it's a little bit like that with the ancestors as well. Having said that, it's a little more permeable. So I've also seen it where someone's done a ton of inner work and like ritual devotional stuff, and it does seem to have really helped the ancestors. But holding intent that the ancestors become healed, that can help more. Like having it actually as a conscious intention tends to, I guess, direct more shift in that direction. But it's not an automatic transfer in my experience. Can I explain a little more how we hear response from them? Yeah, there's not just one way. And this has to do with reclaiming pathways of relationship. It's a kind of decolonizing act. I'm aware that decolonization is not just a metaphor, and it also involves tangible physical change. And I'm saying that cultural recovery from the damage that comes along with colonialism includes reclaiming our ability to relate with the ancestors, and it's doable. And so how does it look? It looks sometimes like audio, like physical, visual. Like most people don't see, like, hey, there's a dead person over here. But sometimes when you close your eyes or you are just seeing on a spirit level, there can be a sense of visual. So it can happen through dreams. It can happen through synchronicities. It can happen through just a felt sense of contact. It's like you learn to recognize a smell or a quality of energy. Like you dream of someone you know, and upon waking, you're like, well, how did you know it was them? Well, it felt like them. I just recognized the feel of them. So it can be like that. And how do you know that they're benevolent? Well, you don't always know. Sometimes they can be a little tricksy and present one way, but not be that way. But often it's the same way you know whether or not you can trust a living person. You just get a sense. And in the same way you get a sense from a living person, be like, yeah, I just need to quietly back up and not be around you. I'm not going to respond to your email or whatever. And so a lot of it's when you're dropped into your body and you have a good safety sense or instinctual sense, a lot of it's intuitive about whether or not you can trust any given ancestor. Another important aspect of that is to have other trusted guides and teachers. Like, let's say you are deeply connected to the spirit of the blue heron and the oak and Bridget, and you are with them when you drop in to make an ancestral connection. And some ancient Irish grandfather shows up and you're like, I think this is safe, but he's a little edgy. And so you turn to your other helpers and be like, do you trust this guy? And they're like, oh yeah, he's just edgy. Or they'll be like, no, you can do better. Like, go farther back. So get a second opinion from your other trusted powers and check in on a different day. Let trust build slowly, but engage in that process of trust building. Yeah, good. Finish pretty soon. There's some interesting questions coming in. I'll speak to a few more. What about child abuse going on again and again through a family history? Yeah, that sucks. There's some limit to how bad it can get, really. And the patterns tend to repeat. And it's more than I want to unpackage now, but for people who are kind of moderate to advanced ritualists, or for people that just have gotten thrown in the deep end around this topic because of life, there's a whole spectrum of forces in spirit that are quite malicious, self-serving, harmful. I don't want to say they're evil. They just have a different diet. If they eat the fear of children, that's just what they eat. But if it's your child, then the fact that it's one of those kind of things that eats that energy will mean that you don't want it to eat your child, hopefully. So sometimes when there are intergenerational patterns of children being exploited, let's say, there are other kinds of spiritual forces which are really not pretty and harmful that are benefiting from that pattern. And most importantly, don't go to war with them. Resource with your wise, loving, healed ancestors. Reach out for support to train practitioners in the work. Don't feel like you have to do that on your own. You wouldn't feel that way about other kinds of trouble, hopefully. Like if you had some complex physical illness, you probably wouldn't be like, all right, well, just going to have some chamomile and trust it sorts out. Hopefully you'd at least talk to a doctor or like Chinese medicine person or somebody. So reach out for support when it's a big intergenerational pattern. But it's possible to interrupt those troubles and re-establish the healed energy. That's, I know it's kind of a general response, but yes, patterns repeat. Yeah, it's as bad as you could describe. And I would encourage you to feel hopeful about it being able to shift. So I'm going to just say that. We'll finish up shortly here. I know it's 90 minutes is a bit of time, but thanks to everyone who's chimed in with the questions, for one. The ways that I've created to engage this kind of work, if you're drawn to it, one is the book, another is the online courses, another, and we had, you know, people from maybe 12 countries last time we ran the course. It runs again in December. Another is through the body of trained practitioners, and they're great and growing. And then another is there's a lot of free talks and such on the website. And then there are trainings in person. So I know it's mostly North America right now, but I'll be guiding the last one. I believe it's the last one in North America. I'm going to guide in Ottawa, Ontario, next month in August. And there's still spaces for that. I say the last one because the people I've trained are starting to step in with that, which is great. So we have trainings this year planned in Nevada City and Berkeley and Asheville and Philadelphia and Victoria and Boulder and Olympia, other places. So, yeah, and do reach out if you aren't in any of those places and you have an interest in a training happening there. So that's what I got. And I appreciate everybody's time and engagement. And I like to say it at the end, it feels true, is be hopeful about your ability to enter this field of relating or this terrain that we're talking about, if it's new to you, in a way that's actually safe and brings more resource and more safety to your life. Not that safety per se is the goal, but it matters if you want to be, well, it matters for all kinds of reasons. It's an appropriate concern, and not all engagement with the unseen is reckless. As possible to engage systematically and safely. So be hopeful about that, and be hopeful about becoming even more aware of the specific kinds of beauty and blessing that are in your bloodlines and in, that you have access to, and that there can be healthy cultural self-esteem that comes from that. And that's good for the world. That's good for sorting out the mess that we're in. So thank you, everybody. And thanks to the ancestors and all that. I'm going to stop recording now.